Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Heidi McKinnon, who has just gotten back from Guatemala, where she's been doing human rights work there. Right now, I would like to welcome Dr. Austin Lundgren. He has pioneered a technique to reverse the vision loss associated with age-related macular degeneration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, this is actually huge. It's an amazing thing that you are doing that probably a lot of people don't know about, which is why I'm having you on the show. First of all, what is age-related macular degeneration, and what's a macula?
Well, the macula is the center part of the retina, and it's critically important in vision, particularly the central vision and color vision. The age-related macular degeneration is by far the most common cause of central vision loss in older adults.
And so why does it begin to degenerate?
That's a good question. Actually, the National Eye Institute spends $2 billion a year studying macular degeneration, and they still haven't determined the mechanism. There's some speculation. I speculate that as we get older, blood supply is reduced every place. It's reduced to our heart, to our brain, to our feet, and so forth, and that it's got to be reduced in the eye also. And when the blood supply gets reduced enough, the brain has to make a decision as to where to allocate the blood. And by blood, I'm talking about oxygen and other nourishment, and not just the liquid itself. And the macula, the center part of the retina, actually uses about 20 times as much blood per square inch as the rest of the retina. So I think that the brain is probably saying, okay, we want to get the most bang for the buck. Let's divert from the macula. Let's divert over to the peripheral vision, which means that the central portion of the vision deteriorates.
Now, the center portion of the vision is very important for a number of reasons.
Well, that's what you use to read. That's what you use to recognize fine objects. It allows color vision. So, absolutely, it's the most important portion of your vision.
So, what is the experience of people who have macular degeneration?
It's several. It starts off, usually people end up having a little fuzzy spot in the center of their vision. Then they require more light in order to read or to identify other objects. That fuzzy spot is called a scotoma. That's an area where vision is missing. It gets bigger and bigger, and eventually people just have great difficulty functioning.
So how do they see? What are they able to see, and what's gone?
Well, in many cases, what happens in more advanced situation is they will have this hole. And so if I'm looking at you, for instance, I might not see your nose, or I might not see anything except your ears, or I might not see anything.
So if you look to the left of me, would then you see me from your peripheral vision?
Yes. Out of the corner of your eye, you can see things. And if you're trying to watch television and you have to look out of the corner of your eye, it's inconvenient. It's hard to read using your peripheral vision. The other thing that happens in addition to scotoma is there's distortion. You look at things that are supposed to be straight, like Venetian blinds or picket fences, and instead they're curved. People who are trying to drive find that it's very annoying to have the line in the middle of the road not straight.
Indeed. If not dangerous.
It can be that. There are three things that most people are particularly concerned about with vision. They'd like to be able to read. They'd like to be able to drive, and they'd like to be able to recognize faces at a distance. I hate to tell you it's very common that people will say that they're very embarrassed because somebody will wave at them from across the street, and they'll not wave back. And the other person thinks that the individual is stuck up or
snubbing them for some reason.
Yeah, but it's just they didn't see. If it's in church and you hear somebody call you, then you can recognize the voice. But
right.
If it's 10 or 15 feet away and it's just a wave, you don't recognize that.
Well, if it's in church, God will forgive you anyway. So you, I was reading some of the literature about macular degeneration, and there's something called wet and dry. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, there are two different types. 90% of people with macular degeneration have the dry form. 10% have wet form, which is more dangerous. The wet form has the potential for bleeding. If you bleed, you suddenly lose a lot of vision. My analogy is if you have an aneurysm in the brain or in the abdomen, it's a potential for having a catastrophe. It doesn't mean you're having a catastrophe right now, but it's a potential. Now, the people who have the worst vision loss most of the time are coming from the wet variety. Many times what they've had is they've had a leak, and the blood itself is toxic. Now, fortunately...
The macula, the part of your eye, inside of your eyeball that sees colors and everything you were talking about, starts bleeding?
There are blood vessels around the macula that are supplying blood to the retina itself.
And they break and start
those,
bleeding.
And those leak. And if they could leak slowly or rapidly. If they leak rapidly, you could lose all your vision in a very short period of time, like a day. If it's slow, it may take longer. The wet variety has gotten the most attention, both because it tends to be the most severe, but also because we have things to do with that. The ophthalmologists have developed over the last 15 years several techniques to stop the bleeding. And so that's very exciting.
Using lasers and so on?
Well, they started off, the first things they did was thermal laser. And that acts like a cautery, and you can stop bleeding if you can identify where the bleeding is. You can't do this for the entire retina, but for about 40% of the retina, you can identify where the bleeding is and stop it. The problem is you have an immediate three-line vision loss when you do that. You're better off than if you didn't use thermal laser, but you still have an immediate significant loss. And since then, we have developed, or they have developed, some other techniques which are very helpful. They started off with something called photodynamic therapy, which is a drug which is injected intravenously, and a cold laser is used to cause coagulation of some of the abnormal blood vessels. And since then, there have been a number of other products that have been developed. Macugen was one. The one that is approved right now and has a lot of publicity is Lucentis. Lucentis is a derivative of Avastin. Avastin is a drug which stops abnormal new blood vessels. Avastin is approved for treatment of certain cancers. Lucentis is a derivative, and Lucentis is specifically approved for treatment of macular degeneration, wet macular degeneration. And it helps stop bleeding. It doesn't improve vision as such. We think that what happens is when the bleeding is stopped, your body reabsorbs blood, which is toxic, and that's how you get to improve vision.
So your blood is toxic when it's not in your blood vessels.
Yes, yes. And Lucentis is very expensive. The charge to Medicare is $2,000 a dose.
Good heavens.
It's very expensive. Many ophthalmologists have gone to using Avastin. Avastin is not specifically approved for treatment of macular degeneration, but it seems to work, and it's much, much less expensive.
So these are treatments for the much less common form of macular degeneration.
Yes.
For the more common form, which is called dry, which means it's not bleeding into your eyeball. Is that right?
Well, it means that it is unlikely to even have that threat of bleeding into the eye.
So for the dry, there is not really a traditional Western medical treatment for macular degeneration.
Correct. There are vitamins, antioxidant vitamins, which slow down the progression of macular degeneration vision loss. Lutein is a substance which has been indicated does improve a little bit, but basically there is nothing to improve the vision of dry macular degeneration.
So how did you start looking for a treatment for this illness, especially with the goal of improving people's vision?
It's a long, shaggy dog story, but basically in 2001, I attended a workshop sponsored by Joe Wong, who is a father of the Canadian neuroanatomic type of acupuncture. That's the type of acupuncture that most Western physicians gravitate to because it is explainable. It, it talks about acupuncture stimulating the production of neurotransmitters and hormones and so forth, and there's scientific evidence on that. Anyway, at that workshop, Joe mentioned that he had been treating macular degeneration, and he was treating people twice a week for 10 weeks, and 35% of them improved vision. Well, my ears perked up because I knew there was nothing to improve macular degeneration at that time, and it became my goal to improve on his technique. And I've modified and improved, and now I have a system that seems to be very effective. And basically, 85% of people I treat improve vision.
That's a very high percentage.
It's a very high percentage, yes.
So what is the nature of your protocol?
I'm using a combination of several different acupuncture techniques. I think it'd be worthwhile to take a little diversion right now. We've focused in the past on the eye as being the source of vision. And if you think about it, what the eyeball does is concentrates light on the photoreceptors in the retina. The light energy from that's received then is converted to an electrical signal, and the electrical signal is identified by the brain. So in many respects, vision is an electrical process.
Right.
It's not just an optical process, it's an electrical one. So what I'm doing is several things. I'm directly electrically stimulating around the eye itself. I'm also stimulating over the brain, over the visual cortex and other portions of the brain that are important in here. And the third thing I'm doing is a German ear acupuncture type of approach. And this is it's very interesting to me. It's not well known in the United States. Until May, there were only three of us in the United States who were doing it. At the same time, there are 15,000 German-speaking physicians in Europe who do it.
Amazing.
You know, if it's not invented here, we aren't going to be interested. Basically,
lots of people do ear acupuncture. I see people walking around with little things taped to their ears.
That's a derivative from the French. I'm using German, and there are more people who do
thing.
More people who do French.
Not to mention Chinese.
Well, the Chinese didn't develop that. It started 65 years ago. The French neurologist Paul Nogier discovered that the external ear sends lots of nerves to the thalamus of the brain. And there's a map. He's identified specific parts of the ear that correspond to specific parts of the brain. He first published, in I think it was 1955, a series of 65 points which corresponded to different parts of the body. His publication was in German, and it was sent to China. And the Chinese looked at it and said, who is this character Nogier? We've been doing acupuncture for a couple thousand years, and all we've identified is 6 points on the ear, and they didn't correspond to specific parts of the body. So the Chinese, being very thorough and interested in investigating,
and open-minded.
Well, yes, they detailed some of their best acupuncturists, and they used the Nanjing Army, one of their big armies, 50,000 men, and did exploration, and they discovered that that Dr. Nogier's map was correct.
So when you stimulate certain parts of the ear, what happens?
It stimulates different parts of the brain. And this there's some hard science on this. David Ellamy is professor of neurology and ear acupuncture at University of Paris Medical School. Imagine having a professor of ear acupuncture and neurology in the U.S. Anyway, what he has done is he has taken needles and put them in the point of the ear that Dr. Nogier had indicated represented the thumb. He did the functional MRI, a real fast MRI of the brain of these people, and discovered that the part of the brain representing the thumb lit up. This is a one-to-one correspondence. It's really cool to have this absolute correspondence. So there is a lot of hard science here. Actually, there's more hard science on this type of acupuncture than in many of the other medical conditions that we sort of take for granted, but have not been researched very extensively.
We're talking to Dr. Alston Lundgren about age-related macular degeneration. So ear acupuncture, then we've got the French, we've got the Germans. The Germans develop a form of ear acupuncture that is distinct in what way?
I get asked this question several times, not just about ear acupuncture, but about acupuncture itself. And I do about 18 different varieties. My analogy is the alphabet is the same in Spanish and German and English and French, but the grammar and the syntax are different. So, yes, we're using needles, but they're put together using different concepts.
So you're doing ear acupuncture as part of the... I mean, let's get back to... Is there a retina point on the ear?
Perhaps, but I don't think so. What I'm doing is specifically developing, generating extra blood flow around the retina, provide more nourishment there. I'm specifically using ear acupuncture to generate extra cortisone production in the body. Cortisone is a wonderful product. We use it for a lot of things. If you take it by pill or take it by injection, you end up with all sorts of terrible side effects, but it's very important for rheumatoid arthritis, for allergies, for asthma, etc. One of the ways that ophthalmologists used to treat macular degeneration is actually inject the eyeball with cortisone. Personally, I'd rather have a little stud put in my ear to produce my own cortisone as opposed to somebody sticking a needle in my eyeball.
And so that works.
And it works.
So you are doing ear acupuncture, you are doing head acupuncture?
Scalp acupuncture. And I'm using a Canadian approach, which is putting needles in the periorbital, the area, the fat that's around the eyeball, and electrically stimulating back there.
And those three things put together... Or is there another one?
Well, I do some others. I add some overall energy to the system. If you know somebody who's been in hospital for major surgery or some big problem, you may notice that they sleep most of the day. And you look around and you say, how come Uncle George is sleeping? He's not doing anything. Well, he is doing something. He's healing that broken hip or some other such situation. So there's a lot of need for extra energy to give you some substance to improve your healing. Also, a big portion of my practice is coming from other parts of the country. They're not at the same altitude as Santa Fe, and I think all of us are aware of visitors who come from out of town oftentimes discover that they have shortness of breath if they climb a couple flights of stairs. So I add energy to help compensate for the altitude change and also for healing. And I also stimulate the body to produce some more parasympathetic effect. The autonomic system that we all have has both a sympathetic and parasympathetic. The sympathetic is mediated by adrenaline, and if somebody goes boo, that's what causes your heart rate to accelerate, your blood to go to your arms and legs so that you can run away or fight. That has to happen opposite control. The opposite control is parasympathetic. That's mediated by the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. Acetylcholine causes the heart rate to slow, the blood pressure to go down. Blood is diverted to your intestines and then digestive system so you can rest and recuperate. Well, all physicians know that the eye has a lot of parasympathetic influence there. For instance, if somebody has a racing heart, it's possible to just push on the eyeball, and that would automatically slow the heart down.
Is that right?
And that's one thing that's done. Now, you want to be a little bit careful how you do it, but it's a well-known phenomenon. So I'm speculating that we want more parasympathetic influence to help with vision. So I'm using some other types of technique to improve the parasympathetic stimulus.
So meanwhile, you have patients coming in. You're doing the protocol that you just described. And people who were looking forward and they see a big hole are now seeing their friends again.
Typically what happens, the progress is slow. I'm not talking about flip a switch and suddenly you can read fine print. But people who have let's call it a dinner plate-sized hole in the middle of their vision, what will happen is that will get smaller and smaller and smaller and becomes the size of a saucer, let's say. Well, a saucer is still a hole. But it's easier to look around a saucer than it is to look around a dinner plate. What happens after the scotoma has gotten smaller in diameter is it begins to get more translucent. And I will have people who say that they had a pure black spot. And for some people, it's for 90% of people, it's a black area. But for 10% of people, it's just they don't see anything there. And they have this black spot, and suddenly they notice it becomes a little bit more translucent. They can say, hey, there's a person back there. I can see that there's a human figure behind it. I can't identify who they are, but it's a human figure. And then as the translucency becomes greater and greater, they begin to identify. I think of this as like having four shower curtains in front of you, and then you peel one of the shower curtains away, and you can see through a little bit better, and you can continue the process.
So have you had patients who have full vision recovery?
I've had my all-time best result is a lady who improved 15 lines on an eye chart. She was an experimental subject back at the beginning, and I treated her a lot of times, and I'm doing things in a better, more difficult, more different, more effective way now. But there you can get a terrific amount of improvement. She started off at 20/1400, meaning that she saw at 20 feet what a person with normal vision would normally see at 1400 feet, and I got her up to 20/40, which means...
That's huge. That's better than I see.
15 lines. That's a lot. And I've had a number of people who will go maybe 8 lines. I don't continue to treat when they aren't improving anymore, but most people have a lot of improvement.
Do you do this, or is it conceivable that it could or should be done preventively?
That's a good question. And originally, I only treated people who... Well, first of all, I only treat people who have the diagnosis of macular degeneration, or there's some other retinal conditions that mimic macular degeneration. So I want an ophthalmologist or optometrist to have made that diagnosis before I treat. I'm not able to help people with cataracts or with corneal problems, etc. It's people who have retinal problems. I used to treat only the people who had symptoms, but I too began to ask myself the question, well, actually what I started to do is I measured their vision over time. And originally, if people had been losing one line of vision per year, and I helped them with 3 lines of vision, I expected that 3 years from now they'd be back where they were to start with. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that once they improve, they maintain that vision. So the rate of decline is either stopped or it's greatly slowed. Well, when I began to recognize that, I said, you know, if people have early macular degeneration and don't have symptoms, it probably would be a good thing to be preventive. And so I've treated a number of people right now. Now, the problem is I don't have enough time, I don't have enough records to identify how much that's working. I have an institutional review board approved study underway right now, which will allow me to track vision over a several year period of time. And over the next couple of years, I expect that we'll have some hard data to be able to share with you.
Because this is such an effective and unusual treatment, I have to ask if you're training other people to do it or encouraging other people to follow in your footsteps.
Well, I've trained several other physicians in my office, and I've tried to make this in the public domain. In fact, it is in the public domain. My publications are listed on the web, and they're available for other people to use.
So anybody can do this without paying you a fee or something like that?
Correct. When I was in medical school, first year of medical school, there was a wonderful microbiology professor who was telling a story of the French gynecologist who first developed obstetric forceps and kept it a family secret for 90 years.
Good heavens.
And it just made a big impression on me that there were tens of thousands of women and babies who died as a result of this being kept for private gain. So that became sort of my goal, to make sure this is in the public domain.
So is this covered by insurance? If somebody has age-related macular degeneration, can they go to your office and be treated and so on?
Well, it turns out it's not considered mainstream medicine.
Right.
It's not covered by insurance. I have written to the coordinators or the administrators for Medicare. They specifically say that this is an experimental procedure, and Medicare does not pay for experimental procedures. Most of the people I'm dealing with are in the Medicare age group, There are a few who are younger, but most, it's as you get older, you get age-related macular degeneration. And most insurance companies do not cover it. They take their guideline from Medicare. Interestingly, there is one insurance that does. The government employees' health insurance, you know, government treats its own better than anybody else, will cover it once every 10 days. But
very interesting. So what are your hopes for having this protocol more widely used?
I am hoping that it becomes mainstream. I've been working for it several years now, and I'm continuing to try to educate other people to the benefits.
Dr. Alston Lundgren is a doctor who has pioneered a technique to reverse the vision loss associated with age-related macular degeneration. He can be found on the web at reverseamd.com. Thank you so much for telling us about all this on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Heidi McKinnon. She is a fellow at the Advocacy Project, which is a Washington, D.C.-based organization. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. And you've just gotten back from Guatemala. You've been working with a Mayan human rights organization there. Tell us what you were doing.
Okay. Well, I work through the Advocacy Project with an organization called Adivima in Rabinal, Baja Verapaz, which is in the center of Guatemala, essentially, and they work with victims of massacres that occurred during the Civil War, mainly from 80 to 84. There are about almost 50 different massacres that occurred just in the two states of Alta Verapaz and Baja Verapaz.
In 80 to 84?
Mm-hmm. And almost 5,000 people died during that time, and there are just so many, obviously so many complications still because of displacement and genocide and the construction of a hydroelectric dam at that time as well, which has really become the focus of my work with Adivima.
So this hydroelectric dam was partially responsible for some of the massacres that you've been studying.
It was. The construction of the dam began in 1975, and at the time, the organization that was in charge of building the dam, INDE, tried to negotiate with some of the communities to a certain degree, but
to say, we're building a dam, you've got to get out of here.
You've got to get out of the way. And so those negotiations essentially fell through. Some of the community members who were leading the negotiations were killed. All of their information about what the government and what INDE was offering to them in reparations, all those documents were essentially lost. And this was 1979. In 1980, a group of seven people were killed in the village of Rio Negro, and that's really where the violence began. And after that, there were five massacres in different villages in the region where the dam was being built, and each one, you know, had a huge toll. The worst was on March 13th, 1982, and 177 women and children died that day. And I've been working with a lot of survivors from those particular massacres.
So this was nearly 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. What is the effect of those massacres on the people who are living there today? How does that history affect what's happening there now?
Well, I've been living in Rabinal on and off for 6 months, and I feel like you see the trauma on people's faces almost every day. I think it just affects every aspect of people's lives. I can't have a conversation with someone without, within two or three sentences, getting to, where a family member died, or hearing about why they moved from their village to Rabinal because of some massacre in the early 80s. It just really, it permeates every aspect of life in that area. And And so over to the point that right now more than 13,000 people have been displaced by the dam and are still living in, you know, very, very marginal homes and have no access to work and food stress all the time. It's a terrible situation.
How far away from their homes did they have to go?
Generally within two hours drive or so. But still, there are so many microclimates in this area that people, when they left Rio Negro or whatever village they had to leave, because there were 28 different villages that were affected by the construction of the dam, they had to adapt to that climate, and so the foods that they were able to grow changed, and just life changed completely for them.
So what is the nature of your work there? What are you actually doing?
Well, when I originally received the fellowship, my proposal was to develop an online exhibit about the history of the construction of the dam and how the communities are surviving today. And when I arrived in Robinal and met with the staff of Adivima, I was essentially handed an economic development plan that was looking for about 125 million quetzales to try to stimulate some development in these communities so people could have access to work, so people could basically put food on the table. And so I felt like that was sort of a mandate. And my research continues, but I also have been trying to help Adivima get funding for the economic development plan and have been trying to initiate the development of a small artisans cooperative amongst all of the communities that were affected, because there are a lot of weavers in this area. In some communities, they've completely lost the ability to weave because of the displacement, honestly. So in some areas, there's a lot of capacity building that needs to be done so that people can regain those skills. But essentially, I've just been trying to organize people so that we can search for funding for the cooperative and get that part moving. But what Adivima wants to do is it's much broader than simply this little cooperative. They need a lot of funding for agricultural development projects and for forestry projects and just essentially for purchasing land so that people from these communities can start working on the land again, because they're living in resettlement villages, a lot of them, and they have no access to plots of land where they can grow beans and corn and, you know,
so it's, it's a whole generation or more than a generation since that mm-hmm. happened, and mm-hmm. people have just been languishing without either help or any resources.
Right. And right now, since 2004, there have been talks with the government, ongoing talks with the government. And just recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, a new political accord was signed between the president of Guatemala, Alvaro Colon, and the communities that were affected by the dam. There's an organization that's part of Adivima called COCAICH, and they are directly involved in the reparations negotiations. So they're the ones who are working with the Colombian administration to try to find some sort of an amicable solution to this, and it's not really working out so well lately. But you know, it's an ongoing process, and we just have to wait and see what happens.
Now, there's a story which has been repeated in many parts of the world, which is that the World Bank lends money to a developing country, they build a dam, the dam silts up and becomes unusable before the money is paid back, and the country mm-hmm. is worse off than it was before. Mm-hmm. Is that dam still at least working?
It's working. It supplies about 40% of the electricity for the entire country of Guatemala, but they do have other dams online now that are going to be under construction in the coming years. So actually, the reparations negotiations for this particular dam, Chixoy or Chixoy, depending on who you're talking to, those negotiations are very important, actually, for these other dams that are going to be coming online, because It's very hard for the government to attract the multinationals who would be able to fund some of these projects without being able to, you know, say that they completed reparations with this dam. But there is silting that's happening. People have said that this dam might only last 40 years without, you know, doing something about the siltation. But essentially, it's a functioning dam, and it's supplying a heck of a lot of energy to the country of Guatemala. And the communities that gave up their land, a lot of them still have the titles to the land underneath the dam.
For whatever that's worth.
Right.
We're talking to Heidi McKinnon, who is part of the Advocacy Project, a D.C.-based organization. You just got back from Guatemala today.
Yes.
Just flew into Albuquerque today. There's an event going on which is called Human Rights Day in Albuquerque, which I guess you are taking part in.
Well, tomorrow night there will be a talk for the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
So this is Wednesday?
Yes.
Tonight.
Yeah. So tonight there will be this talk, and I'll be giving an update on some of my work in Guatemala for the Advocacy Project. And there are a lot of other organizations that will actually be talking as well. I have somewhat of a list. But the UN Association in Albuquerque is organizing this, and the event will be at CNM at Smith Brasher Hall at 7 p.m. I believe there's going to be sort of a meet and greet from 6 to 7.
At UNM?
At CNM.
So what's CNM?
It's I think it's the community college next to UNM. And Bill Pratt is the person who's organizing that. So the other organizations are, well, Amnesty International, the Islamic Center, the UN Association is going to be giving a report, Women in Black, Peace Brigades International, Bread for the World, the Peace Center in Albuquerque, they're also going to be talking. And the keynote speaker is LaDonna Harris.
So this situation that you are observing in Guatemala is part of a much larger picture in Guatemala, which was a horrifying war that went on through the entire Reagan era, and the peace accords were only signed in the late 90s.
96.
Mm-hmm. And so that the whole question of the dam and displacement is just one part of a much larger picture in which people have suffered all kinds of horrors and tortures as a result of that war.
And still suffer today. I recently read a report that stated that the level of femicide in Guatemala is actually reaching the same level as it was during the worst years of the Civil War, 81, 82. So I feel like it's all a part of this trauma that really hasn't been dealt with, that you see all around in, you know, Guatemala City and out in the villages. There are just people who haven't really been able to deal with this situation and find any way to put it behind them, really.
Well, what's it all about? I mean, is it the oligarchy against the indigenous people?
Well, I don't know how you deal with surviving genocide, you know? I don't...
But, I mean, what's the genocide about?
Well, the Guatemala has the second largest population of indigenous people in the Americas after Bolivia. And I'm not really sure I could say what was, you know, what the main focus of all of these massacres and the crimes were. This was just a scorched earth campaign from the late 70s until the mid 80s. That really had to do with these indigenous people being called guerrillas when they clearly were not, and they had just really nothing to do with whatever was going on in the capital. I mean, a lot of the insurgency was masterminded in the capital, but these communities out in Baja Verapaz and Alta Verapaz and Quiche, where most of the violence occurred, it's just, it's almost as if it came out of nowhere, you know, it just came out of the blue. And I can't give you a really good answer for why that was happening.
We're talking to Heidi McKinnon. So what is, you're doing something which is very interesting, which is you are both focusing on the struggles that are going on in Guatemala and the question of how to communicate them through exhibitions.
Right. Well, through all sorts of multimedia avenues, the Advocacy Project does a lot of work trying to help their community-based partners use communication tools, social networking, blogging, any kind of, you know, website development to get the word out. And I see very clearly how much that's needed because the work that Adavima does is so interesting that they just rarely report on it. And there are other organizations that they work with, like Rights Action, which is another advocacy organization based in the U.S. and Canada. And they do support them, and they try to get the word out. Other organizations like Guatemala Solidarity Network and NISQA, they also do definitely report on what's happening. But Adivima themselves, they do so many interesting things, and they just never talk about it. So part of what I've been doing is to try to help them understand how important it is for them to really update their website at the very least. And send out a press release every once in a while, and, you know, start blogging and putting out photos of some of the work that they do, because I mean, not everything that they do is something that, you know, somebody wants to read about. I mean, there are exhumations that they fund every month. Exhumations are going on all the time.
Tell us about that.
There are probably still almost 5,000 clandestine graves in the Vera Pazes, in Baja and Alta Vera Paz alone. Quiche probably has many more. The state of Quiche, which is a bit north of where I've been.
Meaning that the Guatemalan army massacred people, threw them into mass graves, and covered it all up.
Yeah. Also, sometimes they would just leave a body. The family would try to recover it and, you know, bury the person wherever they could, however they could. And then, to this day, they still have a lot of fear about coming forward and saying, well, look, there's this grave, and, you know, maybe we should exhume the body and go through the process, because it's, you know, it's a very political thing to do.
So when a body is exhumed, what happens? It's given a proper burial.
It is. So Adivima helps each family go through the exhumation process, and then they fund the burials. And if the family then wants to go on to try to create a legal case against someone, if they know who the perpetrator was, there is a legal department that takes over from the exhumation department, and then those people will walk the families through the legal process in Guatemala, which is a lengthy one and doesn't always have the greatest results.
The greatest outcome. Well, yeah. Indigenous people in Guatemala and in the United States and lots of other places have been notoriously victims of the legal system or outside mm-hmm. of the legal system. Is that changing? I mean, has international opinion affected that? Has the ending of the conflict in Guatemala affected that at all?
No, there's still just an incredible amount of impunity. Rios Montt, who was the president during the height of the internal conflict or the civil war, became a senator in 2003, and he felt that he was completely absolved of you know, any possible prosecution because of that.
Wow.
So no, there are still plenty of intellectual, you know, actors who masterminded all sorts of massacres, who are living in Rabinal, living in the capital, who have, you know, very important jobs, and no.
Heidi McKinnon, what's next for you?
Well, I will be going back to Guatemala in January, but I'll be working in Washington with the Advocacy Project for a couple of weeks. We're trying to support Adivima's economic development plan, and then the reparations negotiations are still pretty rocky. So we'll just be having, you know, lots of meetings with Inter-American Development Bank, with NGOs, potentially with the World Bank, with lawyers for IDVMA, just trying to kind of get a little bit more support behind what they're doing, and a little bit, give them a little bit more voice through the blogs and through that I've been doing, and just more press releases and just disseminating information for them.
And we will see you tonight in Albuquerque at Human Rights Day.
Yes, you will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Heidi McKinnon is a fellow at the Advocacy Project, which is a group based in Washington, D.C., and is I guess, a Santa Fean as well as anything
else. I am.
It's great to have you on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. You can go there and listen to the show anytime you want to listen, including all the old shows as well, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Pepper Adams. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.